This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, we'll hear about a program that uses movie making to connect and support Cincinnati neighborhoods. Starting us off, the Japanese American Citizens League and Council on American Islamic Relations will be presenting From Citizen to Enemy this Saturday. And the program provides historical context on the dangers of fear-mongering in the United States. During World War II, Japanese Americans were discriminated against and put in internment camps. And today, Islamophobia has resulted in unfair treatment, harassment, and even violence toward those in the Muslim American and Sikh American communities. Here to talk about the parallels between the treatment of Muslims today and that of Japanese Americans during World War II, our National Board Chair for the Council on American Islamic Relations, Rula Alush, Grains of Rice Newsletter Editor for the Japanese American Citizens League, Gordon Yoshikawa, and Cincinnati Sikh community activist Jaipal Singh. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Rula, Gordon, and Jaipal, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Gordon, what was it like to be a Japanese American during World War II? How much discrimination was out there?
There was quite a bit of discrimination. I think discrimination before Pearl Harbor ever happened, because there was anti-Asian feelings in California. But after Pearl Harbor was attacked and President Roosevelt declared war on Japan, it started a whole number of things going. On December 8th, he had declared war on Japan, and also at that time, people were being picked up by the FBI, so they had people lined up already who were going to be picked up. My uncle was one that was picked up in Houston, Texas. He was working for the Japan Trade Bureau in Houston, Texas, and after that, in California, Yuba City, my parents had to sign, go in and get identification cards, and that was with the county. And later in February of 42, they had to get alien registration cards, and these were more in the way of passport, because you had blank pages, but you had their photo, you had their fingerprint, you had their signature, address, a description of height, weight, color of hair, color of eyes. And these they had to show if police would ask them. They had to have that available to be shown.
And Gordon, for the most part, these were people who had committed no crimes. The only reason they were being targeted was because they were Japanese-American citizens, or
that's
Japanese
true.
Ancestry, right?
Yes.
In fact, the majority of the people who ended up in the internment camp had been born in the United States, such as yourself.
Yes, they were.
Now, in 1942, you were, what, 7 years old at the time?
I was 7 years old.
You were talking about how all these things are leading up to what happened in 42. You actually and your family were placed into an internment camp in California, and then later you were transferred to a camp in Utah.
Yes.
Tell me what it was like. What was that like for you as a seven-year-old to have this all of a sudden happen?
Well, we had a little more trauma than that, because in March of 1942, the FBI picked up my father and took him to the city jail and then on to San Francisco. And my sister tried to find out where he went and was unable to do so. So at that time, when evacuation orders came in, my mother had to take care of that, so my sister actually went down. We had to get a family number and find out when and where we were going to be going. And they assigned our numbers 38599, and my sister was -A, my mother was -B, and I was down to dash F. But they even included my father's name as dash G, and he wasn't even there, and we didn't know where he was. So when we finally were evacuated by train to Northern California to a place called Tule Lake, we had gone by train, and then were trucked in on Army trucks into the camp that was had barbed wire fence and guard towers. And when we got to our block, we saw that our father was running behind the truck to greet us. So that's the first time we had seen him in 4 months. So that was a nice greeting.
I can imagine. Were a lot of Japanese Americans forced to sell their homes, their land, their businesses because of this?
If they had time, they would, but some people on like Bainbridge Island, Washington, or Terminal Island in the Bay Area had like 5 days to pack up and leave. We're better off because we had from up till July to do so. The western states were divided into Zone 1, Zone 2. Zone 1 was on the western part, Zone 2 the rest. And the Zone 1 people were moved out in May, and we were fortunate enough to have a little bit more time, but we were unable to sell the rooming house that my mother had. Probably sold the car, but there wasn't anything else that we could do. So we packed up whatever we had and stored it in a government warehouse. So it was sort of traumatic.
Yeah, I can imagine. What were the conditions like? You say there's a camp that had a barbed wire fence. What were the conditions like? What was life like inside the camp?
Well, the camps were usually in desolate areas. So the one in at Tule Lake in Northern California was used to be a lake bed, so it's basically a desert. And the barracks were sort of bare. They were tar papered, had no heat other than a pot-bellied coal-burning stove for the wintertime. But it was sort of a strange place for us to go all of a sudden. The clothing that we had were probably wrong. We went there in July, so it wasn't too bad. But coming wintertime, everybody was ordering clothes through Sears and Roebuck and things like that. And the barrack life was a big change because the block consisted of maybe 15 barracks. And in the center was laundry. They had men and women's latrines and showers. So now this was something other than what they're used to. We had a mess hall. So it was everybody going to the mess hall now. So you had no facilities within the barracks like you had at home. In the day or in the nighttime, if you had to go to the bathroom, then you had to take like a little walk to get there. So that was quite traumatic for many people.
How has that experience from your childhood, how has that shaped your life today?
Well, the childhood, kids are kids anywhere.
I think you're pretty resilient.
And yeah, usually they find something good in whatever is going on. We would play in a coal pile. We would dig up things. We would hunt for scorpions. I mean, these were kids' things. And that sort of kept us going. I think the older people, people who were just out of high school or had started college and when all this came about, were affected much more.
Now, in 1968, nearly two dozen years after the camps were closed, the government starts making reparations to Japanese Americans for the property they had lost. In 1988, the Congress passes legislation which awarded formal payments of $20,000 each to surviving internees.
Yes.
Now, how did you feel when the government finally started to say, "Oops, we're sorry, we'll try to make it up to you"? I mean, how did you feel when those reparations finally started?
Well, I think that was really a breaking point. Up to that point, none of the people that were incarcerated really spoke about it. I think when the hearings were starting to go through and people at home were being interviewed, then they started to bring out the memories. And I think that really started everything going, and people were starting to admit what had happened.
How important do you think it is, the story of what happened with the internment camps? How relevant is that to today? How important is it to keep that whole story in mind?
Well, I think it's very important because what had happened was because we look like the enemy. And that perception really brings about a lot of things. So when 9/11 came, we were quite concerned how it was going to affect Muslims, because everybody was going to look at them as the enemy, and we had experienced that.
Rula, what do you think? How does looking back at what happened with the Japanese Americans being interned, incarcerated, how does that help us to understand what's going on today?
Yeah, I think it's really important. You know, it's difficult to hear, and I appreciate Gordon coming forward and others like him sharing their story and sharing the history so that we know what happened in the past and not that far off past. I mean, it's more recent than many of us would care to believe and know, but it's important to know that that's the history of what happened in this country. And there are so many parallels, I think, and similarities to some of the issues that are facing Muslim Americans and Sikh Americans and other members in our communities that are finding themselves in situations where they're being treated in violent or hateful ways because of racism, xenophobia, and other issues like that.
Mm-hmm. And Jaipal, from your perspective, how important, how relevant do you think it is to keep this story in mind and putting things in context today? How does that help us?
I think Gordon hit it right on point when he was talking about the image of the other, and I think that's something, this idea of otherism and otherness that essentially alienates man from each other, and the Sikh tenets only promote equality and love and peace and justice, and those are American values. And it's incredibly crucial to always remember our history. You remove a people's history and you remove who they really are.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join the conversation. And we will continue that conversation in just a few minutes. Again, you can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. And thanks to Maria Brock for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, here to talk about the parallels between the treatment of Muslims today and that of Japanese Americans during World War II. Our national board chair for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Rula Alush, Grains of Rice newsletter editor for the Japanese American Citizens League, Gordon Yoshikawa, and Cincinnati Sikh community activist Jaipal Singh. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jaipal, as far as Sikh Americans go, what are they facing these days, and why are they facing this?
Well, I talked about briefly before the break the idea of the other. Edward Said, in his book Multiculturalism, introduced this a couple decades ago. And it's that idea of seeing one another as different. You know, in post-9/11 America, attack on any one of us, any group that's seen as different, is an attack on all of us. And what we're doing as a Sikh coalition, Sikh community, working with the White House, Department of Justice, FBI, is actually trying to document those hate crimes, whether it's an act of violence or act of hate speech, document those incidents across the country in local law enforcement, local jurisdictions, create awareness, create education to teach that Muslim values, Sikh values, Hindu values, whatever group you name, that all of these values can be and are American values.
How much, in terms of numbers, how much of this kind of thing is the Sikh community facing? I mean, what paint the picture for me. What exactly is going on?
Last year alone, we had over 5,000 incidents documented, and those are the ones that are documented. We have only 20% of local law enforcement jurisdictions, local law force agencies, I should say, that are currently documenting. And so 20%, excuse me, that are not documenting. So there is a space in here with which a lot of work is required. The FBI and the Sikh Coalition have worked together. There is a law that has been passed now that hate crimes will finally be documented as for what they are. So a hate crime towards a Muslim is documented as such. A hate crime towards a Sikh is documented as such, and so on and so forth. Previously, that was not the case. So all of the previous data is bunk in a lot of ways because we don't even have that information. Currently now, the effort, now that that law has been passed, is to actually get the local law enforcement agencies to document those. But that requires that they know who we are. So most Americans, the majority of Americans, great people, wonderful, kind-hearted people, Americans, all of us, unfortunately, there's a pure ignorance out there of who we all are. There isn't enough dialogue. It's starting, but obviously the mainstream media, there's, you know, everybody knows about that discussion. There's all kinds of hateful speech, all kinds of negativity that's being spread. And what we need to do is focus on the commonalities between all of us, the love, the equality, the peace, those values that are true and true. You know, we all bleed red. You know, and reminding one another of those things is important. There's actually, I was reading the other day, there's a Navajo tradition of when any crime is perpetrated against an individual in those communities, the native communities, what they do is they work together to get the individual, the victim, and the offender, and both communities to work together and to recognize that they are all one people. And to then not essentially victimize or target that individual as being bad, but the action, that all people are good inherently, all people are divine inherently, but the behavior, the action, that's what must be persecuted.
And Jaipal, when we talk about 5,000 incidents, we're talking about all ranges of different kinds of incidents, from harassment to violence.
To houses of worship being vandalized, houses of worship being attacked. In Oak Creek, Wisconsin, August 2012, six Sikh Americans were murdered, and one lieutenant, Brian Murphy, of the local police force there, he was injured, critically injured, and then he has now since recovered, but he actually stood up. But that was one of the first mass shooting in an American house of worship. We've seen documentation of, and we get it every day, of just hate speech on all kinds of levels. I myself have helped prosecute an individual who I was a, quote, victim of. But then there was also many, many cases of actual physical violence, beaten people, and taxi drivers on the highway being attacked in their cars. They stopped, pulled out the car, pulled over, got out of the car on the highway, and the beatings continued. Things like that. And this individual in New York, he actually got run over by a pickup truck, and luckily survived that. Days later, he actually released a video, and it's important. He released this video saying that I, through and through, forgive that attacker, because it's not about the individual. It's not about that person doing the wrong. It's actually about their teachings, what they've grown up with, their mindset, And those actions, and again, those are the things that we need to help mitigate.
Rula, what about Muslim Americans? I mean, what are they facing these days?
Yeah, there's so many issues I think that the Muslim American community is facing. We're seeing certainly an increase in hate crimes and attacks against Muslims, physically violent attacks, threats against mosques. Mosques across the country have been targeted, and there's certainly been an increase in more recent times, but this is something that the community is facing as a whole. Also, just personal incidents of attacks against individuals, people that are verbally harassed and at times physically assaulted, oftentimes in ways that when they're reporting this, it's references specifically to them as Muslims or to an appearance of them as Muslim, Muslim Americans. And women in our community are specifically facing these issues as people that, especially those who wear the headscarf or hijab, as I have on today, being targeted specifically for their religious beliefs. Another phenomenon that's been happening far too often lately is this issue of, it's been deemed flying while Muslim, but Muslim Americans that are boarding planes and ready to fly as any other passenger on the flight, being asked to deboard simply because a flight attendant may have felt uncomfortable with them. And when those instances are being investigated, the issues or the things that were making the flight attendant uncomfortable were nothing other than the person's appearance or use of Arabic language, for example. Very just concerning facts that are coming out.
Just to cut in and to add to that,
go right ahead, Jeff.
Hollywood Sikh actor who has a turban, has a beard. He was traveling just on vacation, and he was not allowed back on the plane back to the U.S. And he's a well-known actor who has, you know, in big motion pictures with Clive Owen and and all the others. So,
do people confuse Sikhs with Muslims? Is that one of the reasons that you're
again,
your
yeah,
faith is it, facing it, this?
There's a lot of ignorance just out there in terms of who a Muslim is, who a Sikh is. But again, an attack on all of us is an attack on all of us. Very few people know that the Sikh religion is, you know, founded 500 years ago in northern India. It's the fifth largest religion in the world, over 20 million followers spread out across the world. You know, I myself was born and raised here in Liberty Township, grew up, went to Lakota High School, played t-ball, football. I scored a touchdown as a little kid down in Riverfront Stadium. You know, my dad, he worked at General Electric. My mom worked at the IRS. You know, we had an Oldsmobile. I love apple pie. You know, all these sorts of American things. This is my home. And in the same way that Gordon earlier was talking about the Japanese American experience, and, you know, I can only imagine what it must feel to be reduced down to a number.
Yeah.
In the same way that the speech and the rhetoric that we're hearing currently is creating such a violent air out there, really, for people, and allowing this space for these things to be said and these things to be done, which are unheard of and absolutely unacceptable.
Rula, the title of the conference that's coming up, Citizen to Enemy, is that really how it feels?
Yeah, unfortunately it does. I think that many in the Muslim American community feel as though we're being ostracized, certainly being treated as this other, and the other being an enemy. And I think many in our community are feeling like there's a test of our loyalty or a test of our patriotism as Americans. And when I, you know, when we're talking about what's important about knowing the history of what happened to Japanese Americans in the past, I think one of the issues that's relevant is that similar comparison, that loyalty was being tested simply because of who they were. And in present days, I think Muslim Americans are finding that we feel like our loyalty and our presence as American Muslims is being questioned just because of our faith.
Is that due in part to the media?
Certainly it plays a part. I think there's a lot of misinformation and ignorance about Islam and Muslims, some of which is perpetuated by the media. And, you know, I think negative stories being put forth about Muslims when, you know, there are so many Muslims of various backgrounds in our country doing amazing things. you know, recently we had the Olympics, and it was beautiful to see Muslim American Olympians that were gold medal winning in some instances and just representing our country, part of Team USA. That's representative of who the American Muslim community is.
How can we change that perception, though?
I think it's important to have programs like the one we're having and have discussion and dialogue. I think the more people get to know one another, the less room there is for this fear based on misinformation or based on lack of knowledge of other human beings. And then I think going back to the point that Jaipal made about turning individuals into the other, I think that's something that we've seen happen in history, that people that are put into this segment of their and other, it's much easier for everyone else then to stand by and not show solidarity and not stand in support of those groups. And so one of the things I think that's very important for the rest of us to do is make sure that we're not only defending or representing ourselves, but that we're standing in solidarity with other organizations or communities that may find themselves victimized or being attacked based on demographics, racism, or other features. You know, we all have to make sure that we're protecting and preserving our American values of making sure everyone's being treated equally.
So tell me about the program. When and where? So
specifics we can get to you, but we're going to be at the University of Cincinnati. It'll be on this Saturday coming up on the 27th, and I think hopefully it'll provide people the opportunity to hear a lot about the history. You know, looking forward to hearing Gordon share
even
more.
Gordon's part of the panel.
Sure.
Yes.
So looking forward to hearing him share more about what we're going to be, the history of what's taken place, and then also giving Jaipal and I the opportunity to talk about what's impacting the Sikh American community, the Muslim American community, and hopefully have question and answer and dialogue about these issues so that we can, you know, talk constructively and move forward.
And how we can celebrate our diversity, because that's truly what America is.
Is that the big message you'd like to see people get out of this conference?
I mean, I think that's one of the messages, of course, but I mean, you know, America's founded on that idea and those words. You know, we hold these truths to be evident, that all men and women are created equal, and those are certainly Sikh values, those are American values, and it's a beautiful idea to bring so many different cultures and different ideas together to celebrate, you know, freedom, true freedom, because that's at the core of every human being. That's what we're after.
Jaipal and Gordon Rolo, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
National Board Chair for the Council on American Islamic Relations, Rula Alush, Grains of Rice Newsletter Editor for the Japanese American Citizens League, Gordon Yoshikawa, and Cincinnati Sikh Community Activist Jaipal Singh.
Thank you.
From Citizen to Enemy, a moderated panel followed by a group discussion and a question and answer session takes place on Saturday. It's going to be from 2 to 4 at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. And you can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. Coming up, using movie making to connect and support local neighborhoods. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.